Hello, everyone. I'd like to thank Jim and the practice community, practice committee, for inviting me to come talk. I know it's no small thing to be asked to do this, and I'm humbled by it. Thank you. Also, thanks for people for coming out in this weather. I know when I was leaving, the thunderstorm was so intense. If I wasn't talking tonight, I'd probably be watching from home. As mentioned, the theme of the talk tonight, oh, and thanks, hello everyone on Zoom, thanks for attending. As mentioned, the talk tonight is about the Simplicity Zen podcast. For those who don't know, the Simplicity Zen podcast is a podcast primarily revolving around interviewing kind of senior practitioners and different Dharma teachers, mostly in the Zen, you know, like 99% Zen teachers, had a few non-Zen teachers. I was kind of inspired to do it, well, stepping back a little bit. The reason I did this in the first place was, and I mentioned this last week for those that were here, but I'll repeat it again. In the lineage that I got ordained in, there's a strong kind of theme of service. You know, it's kind of the general gist of the lineage is that, you know, you're by getting ordained, you're switching the arrow of your practice from just practicing for yourself to, you know, practicing for the wider community. And so as part of that, everyone's kind of expected, and no one calls it a service project besides me, but you're basically expected to do a service project as part of your priesthood, you know, giving back to the community and larger Mahasangha in some sort of dharmic way. The vast majority of people in the lineage, they'll either do hospital or prison chaplains, or they'll start sitting groups. I got ordained during COVID. And so, you know, everything was shut down. So at first, starting a sitting group was not really a possibility. We actually rented a place, but then COVID came back. And so it was just my wife and I sitting by ourselves. We didn't actually advertise it. But I needed to find some alternative ways to kind of do some service activities. And one thing I did is we did these outdoor silent hikes, you know, through the American River Conservancy, and then that kind of morphed into like hikes, qigong, and an outdoor kind of guided meditation. Another thing I did is I've, from the earliest time, you know, decades ago, I've always been interested in kind of the neural correlates of practice. And really, in the last 7 years, the science has finally kind of gotten to the point, because I've always kind of been keeping tabs on it. But like over the last 7 years or so, the science is starting to caught up where we're actually kind of getting a sense of what's actually going in on our brain, what's going on, happening inside our brains, and giving us an idea of, you know, why humans suffer and why meditation mitigates that and so forth. So I kind of crystallized all my research into this Science of Zen website. So that was another one of my projects. And then my third project was starting this podcast. I first got the idea, there's this podcast called, what's it called? Buddha at the Gas Pump. And it's actually quite popular. Like, I've discovered that there's a much bigger world of like non-dual practitioners than there are Zen people. I mean, there's like, this podcast gets like, you know, tens of thousands of, you know, viewers. I mean, there's a, you know, and all the people who get wealthy being meditation teachers, they're all kind of in that non-dual world. I found out about it because he interviewed Henry Shookman. He's a Zen teacher I really like. And so I saw his interview there, and that's how I discovered the podcast series. And I'm like, oh, someone should do that for Zen. And I'm like, oh, maybe I'll do it for Zen. And so I got, you know, first couple guests were kind of some friends that I knew would feel obligated to say yes. And then it kind of snowballed from there. And the reason I like it and the reason I was motivated to do it is because looking back at my own practice path, it was never like sutras or like, you know, commentaries or Dharma talks or anything like that, that even remotely spoke to me and got me interested in practice. It was narrative stories of people's practice journeys. I was even somehow blundered upon some Dogen early on, and that, I mean, you can imagine, you know, that did not speak to me at all. And, but hearing like people actually practicing and it working for them, and it's like seen as a practice as not just a bunch of ideas, but as actually something people do, that's what got me into practice. And real specific, and people have heard my like talk, you know, other what's it called, the people give a talk about their practice, way seeking mind talks. You know, what got me into practice was I frankly took psychedelics and at Grateful Dead concerts, and I just, this whole new universe opened up to me. And like, I didn't know anything about Buddhism or any of that, or Hinduism. You know, I thought Buddhism was like bowing to a fat guy on an altar. That was like the extent of my knowledge of Buddhism. But I just through experiences, you know, I was having encounters with, you know, oneness, non-dualism, kind of the oneness of all being, you know, these were things that I was seeing, and I was like, and it was, you know, just remarkably healing. And, you know, I felt like I was going home to something that was like original and primordial. And, you know, it was like, I realized right away that the experiences I were having were not, the path. They were just like an introduction to the existence of a path. So very early on, I went and I started just reading about spiritual traditions, you know. And for like the first thing that kind of interested me was shamanism. You know, I read all the Carlos Castaneda books, and it's about 3/4 of the way through them where I'm like, these probably aren't real, you know. And anyone read those books? Yeah, I mean, they're fascinating. I mean, the guy's a brilliant writer, but a really, again, it was kind of a narrative that kind of grabbed me, you know. And and then, you know, I read about, you know, kind of more contemporary shamanism, but it didn't really scratch the itch. But then I was reading this book called, I think, The Tao of Physics. Have you guys ever heard that book? And they mentioned in the book about how his take on it, and I don't really agree with this, but like, you know, the non-conceptualization of Zen was mapping really closely with the kind of the inability of humans to conceptualize what's happening at the subatomic level. And I'm like, so that kind of intrigued me about Zen. And then the second book I read was Three Pillars of Zen. And, you know, I read those, you know, like most people, I went straight to the Enlightenment Stories chapter. And it was just remarkable to me that these experiences people were reporting in those chapters so closely mapped to what I just blundered upon, you know. And that kind of made Zen appealing to me in a couple of ways. One is it was authentic, right? You know, it was about waking up. You know, it wasn't like this philosophy that you need to try to follow or something. It was, you know, direct apprehension of ultimate reality. And also the fact that there was these contemporary accounts of people going down the path made it seem possible, right? And then I started reading about Zen, and I think I owned Moon in a Dewdrop at one point, you know, and I just it was impenetrable to me, you know. And but I would read, I always liked, you know, a lot of times you have a book and the first like couple chapters are about the biography of the teacher and then his Dharma talks. I would always only read the biographies because those are what were fascinating to me. And so knowing that in my history, I thought, well, maybe this will resonate to other people, and hearing other people's histories will motivate them to practice. So really, my whole goal of the project was just to kind of ignite people's bodhicitta, like motivate them to practice. I've gotten used to it now, but I was very uncomfortable, taping these at first, knowing, hundreds or maybe even thousands of people would watch it. But I've gotten used to it. Like even this Dharma talk, I wasn't even that nervous after doing 80 podcasts. It's been fairly popular. No Buddha in the gas tank, but some of the podcasts have gotten over 2,000 views and so forth. Very gratifying. People have reached out to me and they found sanghas, they found teachers, they've been motivated to practice. So at least a little bit has worked. What I was aiming towards has worked. I even had a teacher that's actually taught here to me before. She reached out to me and says, I'm so grateful for having got on your podcast because, a sangha found me and invited me to teach. So she actually, has a sangha now because of the podcast. So that's been really gratifying. With in mind that, by the way, if anyone has any questions or comments, stop me and talk. I as much as this is a conversation would be great. Does anyone have any questions so far or comments or? Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
No problem.
Thanks. Thank you for your service project, Barry.
Thank you.
I was very impressed by your interview with Tim Burkett that we saw last week. Where did you pick up your interview skills?
I didn't. I have my personality. When I'm interested in something, I'm just voracious about wanting to know more about it. So just very natural for me to be curious, and people like talking about themselves, so it's pretty easy.
Do you do much preparation?
No, I don't. I probably should do more, but I'm able to get away with it just because I've done so much reading on Zen in general and have just a general sense of the Zen scene in America that I generally am able to kind of ask, relevant questions just based on general knowledge. A couple times I've embarrassed myself where they'll be like, I wrote this book. And I'm like, oh, I own that book. I didn't realize that. That's probably happened 4 or 5 times, where that's how little preparation I did. I didn't even know that they were the author of books sitting on my shelf, I've generally found that the interviews where I have less preconceptions of what I want to talk about or go with are generally the better interviews, where it just kind of unfolds organically, which I guess should be no surprise. I've never given a thought to how to interview anyone or anything like that.
Thank you, Barry.
All right, so before we get to the end, I want to talk a little bit about kind of what I've learned from the podcast, because I have learned some things, kind of doing a wide survey. I think I've had 80 podcasts. And by the way, I've taken a break about 2 months ago. The company I worked for kind of had a little rough time, and it kind of dawned on me, I should probably get my degree because I have to go back to the workforce. And so, because I never finished my computer science degree, I was pulled away out of school to join a startup, and I just have worked since then. And the market's kind of rough right now. So I've gone back to college, believe it or not, at 51. And so I've just been, every free moment, and it's online and at your own pace. So I've just, every free moment I'm working on a course. And so I've taken a break from the podcast, but I plan to get back to it. But anyway, one other thing I wanted to talk about, why narratives are kind of interesting to people. And this kind of maps to my interest in the science of Zen a little bit. I thought this would be interesting to touch on. Humans are fascinated by narratives in general. And if you think about it, anyone who's worked in the office, water cooler talk, what's it about? It's usually, if not a narrative of some sort of gossip that's happening, or they're talking about a movie or a show that's hot. These are all narrative activities. And human beings are just obsessed with narratives. And it actually kind of is relevant to practice a little bit, because you know, when you look at the way the brain works, there's this really fascinating experiment they did where they took this comedian telling the story. And I don't know how long the whole story is. I think maybe 10 minutes or something. And the first, and what they did is they broke it up in little pieces. And the first thing they did was they extracted syllables, like maybe there's a word before, and so it'd be for, you know, like they would just extract the syllables from this recorded story, and then they scrambled the syllables, and so it just sounded like like that, and then they stuck people in scanners, you know, in fMRI scanners, and the part of the brain that light up is would be kind of like the back, and that's the part that just like is like looking at the raw data. What are these, what are the vibrations of the sounds entering the ear? You know, there's no comprehension at all. It's just like, it's just the activity, right? And then they put the words back together, but they did the words out of order. So it'd be like before, someday, and then, or actually, and then can't, it's Christmas, you know, like, you know, it's really hard to say things that make no sense if you ever tried, but it's, you know, and so the what would light up would, a little bit more further would light up in the brain, you know, start in the back and start moving to the kind of the front of the back. And then they would do whole sentences, but chopped up. And so it'd be like, and then on Sunday, I went to the store. Can you believe she said that? And then I fell down. You know what I mean? So like, there's still no narrative, but the sentences, you know, there's are kind of grammatically correct. And it moved, and the light, it moved more lit up in the brain. And then they, I think at that point, they just played the whole story. And what happened is it lit up all the way to the front. And then down, and so our brains are like, kind of like a walnut. There's like two halves and they're stuck together, right? And where my thumbs are, that's like the corpus callosum, and that's like the part that connects the two brains. But in this valley where the two brains are squished together, it's called the midline regions. And those are all the regions that light up when people think about self and other. Or just self or just other, it's those midline regions, like in the valley of the brain that light up. But what was interesting was those were also the areas that lit up when people heard an entire narrative. It was only once they got the narrative that the self parts of the brain lit up. And if you think about it, you know, a self only exists because there's a past and a future, right? You know, you have a memory of things that happened and you have a assumption of future possibilities, and this, and that's where the self lives. And you know, meditating is bringing you back to the absolute reality of the moment. And when you do that, those self areas go offline. And so it's just really fascinating, and it makes sense that people are interested in narratives because that's kind of what we are. We are narratives, you know, and that's how we survive as a species. Because you know we sit, you know, we create these. Oh, and also these parts of these is the abstract thinking. You know, where you know you're not thinking about the reality of the moment. You're thinking like, well, if I get my computer science degree, that might be good 5 years from now. You know, like that's that part of the brain, like this long-term temporal processing of reality. And so really, you know, narratives in a lot of way are our problem. You know, like thank God we have them. You know, like. Can you imagine not having never watched The Sopranos or, you know, like, you know, it's like, I really like narratives and they're who we are and they help us survive. But they also is like what causes problems. You know, when our narratives get out of control and we're like, we can't see, you know, a good way out, that's when we start, you know, ruminating about stuff and getting upset about life. So in a lot of ways, you know, narratives are the problem. So I think it's also interesting that, you know, since we are so interested in narratives, it can also be a gateway into the Dharma, you know, so it's kind of a double-edged sword, you know, like narrative, you know, and if you think about our tradition, you know, what kind of makes Zen unique? You know, one thing is, you know, the centrality of the student-teacher relationship, you know, like an emphasis of awakening in this lifetime, you know, I think kind of Zen people take that for granted. Like a lot of Buddhist traditions, they're thinking, you know, many lifetimes down the road for awakening. Like Zen is one of the few traditions where, like, you know, waking up right now is what's important, you know. But another thing that makes Zen unique, I think, is our really the centrality of koans, you know. And, you know, and koans are stories, you know, for the most part. There's some that are just like one-liner quips, but for the most part, they're narratives, they're stories. And so, you know, so narratives are just like really fundamentally part of our tradition too. And so with that in mind, so I wanted to, so I mentioned earlier how, you know, it was reading these narratives that kind of got me interested in Zen. And as I was giving this talk, I kind of went back and revisited some of these. So I thought it might be interesting if I kind of share a few that were meaningful, you know, to me 30 years ago. Oscar?
A story, a narrative, very brief.
Yeah.
One of the first teachings I remember getting from my teacher, Reb Anderson, years and years ago when he was coming to Sacramento regularly, occasionally, was that we humans are storytelling machines. And when we see through our stories, they turn into light.
Absolutely.
I've been thinking about that for about 20 years.
That's wonderful.
It's nice to hear you talk
about it. Yeah, I mean, that's my thesis right there. So the first kind of little section, and man, this is probably too much to read, but maybe I'll paraphrase them. But so first of all, a lot of these are awakening stories, and so I just want to say that you know, I'm not kind of proselytize. You know, I like the way I work with the few students I have is like I don't emphasize Kensho at all. If it happens organically, then we work with it. But I definitely am a firm believer that practice can happen, you know, from the bottom up, you know, where you approach it from the day-to-day moment of your life. And I think for most people, that's actually probably the best path. So I'm not, like a danger, you know, a concern whenever someone talks about Kensho or awakening or anything is it seems like, you know, you'd be like, well, this is what has to happen for you to practice. And that's not my intention at all here. So I just wanted to say that preemptively. Anyway, so the first story, you know, I told you I was really fascinated by the three pillars of Zen. You know, as this 19-year-old kid sitting on, and I remember I was like sitting in the guest room at my grandma's house in Sun Valley, Idaho, and it was snowing. And it was really quiet, and you know, it was at night, and you could see the snow falling through the trees. And I remember reading this, and it was just such an evocative experience. I mean, it was like, it was life changing for me. But anyway, so the first story I read was this. This first person, you know, so the Enlightenment stories there, they're all, you know, they're all firsthand accounts, you know, you know, people would write of their experiences. And so this story, it's anonymous in the book, but it's Yamada Koan. He's the one person who, he was Harada Yasutani's, Yasutani Roshi's Dharma heir, and they started like the Sambo Zen, and that's like branched off to Robert Aiken in Hawaii and Maizumi Roshi in LA. So like a really large number of people practicing in America generally either come from Suzuki Roshi's lineage or Harada Roshi's lineage. And then of course there's, you know, Katagiri and so forth. But anyway, so Yamada Koan, who wrote this section, he, you know, he ended up becoming the abbot of Sambo Kyodan. And so the story, so basically what it was is he was coming home from a sesshin. He was on the train, and I was going to read all these, but I'll just paraphrase them. Well, I'll say this part. So he read this quote of sitting on the train. I came to realize clearly that mind is no other than the mountains and rivers and the great wide earth, the sun and the moon and the stars. And he mentions that he'd read this before. But just, you know, have you ever been like, it happens with me, Dogen, a lot. You know, you're chanting and just a line hits you that maybe you've read 1,000 times. Like, it always seems to be when I'm chanting for some reason. Dogen particularly. Like, it just resonates like it never has before. Has that ever happened to you guys? Happens to me quite often. But anyway, so it seems that he had this type of experience. And he writes, like, after 7 or 8 years of Zen, he'd read this before. But it was startled when he read his sign. And he says, like, after 7 or 8 years of Zazen, I have finally perceived the essence of the statement. And you know, he just started crying. He was just, it was so beautiful. Like, he just, I think he had this, like, intuitive glimpse of his true nature. And then, so he he, you know, arrived off the train, got home from the sashin, and he writes, in my present exhilarated frame of mind, I could rise to the greatest heights. You know, very humble. And then, so that night he was sleeping, and he writes, at midnight I abruptly awakened. At first my mind was foggy, then suddenly the quotation flashed into my consciousness. I came to realize clearly that mind is no other than the mountains, rivers, and the great white earth, sun and the moon and the stars. And I repeated it. Then all at once I was struck by lightning, and the next instant heaven and earth crumbled and disappeared. Instantaneously, like surging waves, a tremendous delight welled up in me, a veritable hurricane of delight, and I laughed loudly, ha 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 ha, ha ha ha. There's no reason here. There's no reason at all. Ha ha ha. Anyway, so yeah, this dramatic awakening experience has, again, it doesn't happen that way for most people, and it's not necessarily even a good thing. You know, you can not be ready for it. But as a 19-year-old kid laying in bed, like that hit me. You know, because it, like, you know, my little Grateful Dead excursions were, you know, very subtle compared to that. But like I'm like, people are having these experiences naturally. This is a real thing. It was just so incredible for me to read this. And I mean, literally from that moment, Zen became my dominant direction of life. And that was well over 30 years ago at this point. And he says, Sakyamuni and the patriarchs haven't deceived me. They haven't deceived me. And later, like his family reports, like he sounded like a crazy person with his like manic laughter, and they thought he was going crazy. But anyway, it ended up being a very powerful experience for him. And another chapter and another section in that chapter kind of was the opposite thing, where this guy, this other person was sitting, and he was working on Mu. There's a koan Mu. If those aren't familiar with it, a monk asked Joshu, does a Buddha have does a dog have Buddha nature or not? And Joshua answered him, moo! And that moo means like does not, or negation, or empty even, or negative. And so the koan is, you know, why? Because like obviously if you know anything about Mahayana Buddhism, a dog does have Buddha nature. Everything has Buddha nature. So why would he say that a dog doesn't have Buddha nature? Well, that's the koan. And he's working on moo. And he says, I experienced a state in which I felt as though I were looking at a vast, utterly transparent sky. And the next moment, was able to penetrate the world of Mu with an awareness that was clear and sharp. And then he went to his teacher verified it. But what I thought was interesting about this is his teacher says this afterwards. There's a tremendous difference between shallow and deep realization. And these different levels are depicted in the 10 ox herding pictures. The depth of your enlightenment is no greater than what is shown in the third picture, namely that of seeing the ox. In other words, you've only caught a glimpse of the realm beyond the manifestation of form. Your kensho is such that you can easily lose sight of it if you become lazy and forego further practice. So that was really powerful for me to read, because in the three pillars of Zen is somewhat rightfully criticized of creating this like artificial belief that, you know, you have an awakening experience and then you live in, you know, happy world ever, you know, thereafter. But there are chapters in the book where they pointed out that, you know, any sort of intuitive grasp of absolute reality is really just the first step in practice. You know, it's not the destination. And so that stuck with me really on. And then after that, I think the second Zen stuff I read, well, actually first I read Zen Flesh and Bones. You know, that was the second book I read, which again is a bunch of narratives. And the one that story that stuck with me from that one was, even though the author kind of messed up the teacher, like this woman got pregnant, you know, and this is like 1600 era Japan, and they said, who's the father? And she's like, Hakuin, who was just like this priest. And they're like, the parents like stormed to the temple, like, how dare you like betray my daughter and your vows? Now you have to take care of this baby. And he says, like, oh, is that so? Okay, and he took care of the baby and he got a wet nurse or whatever. You know. And then eventually the girl was full of guilt and admitted who the father really was. It was like, you know, some other kid in the village. And they went back and they apologized. He's like, oh, is that so? And You know, and that's where I'm like, oh, you know, if you practice, you can get to the point where, you know, there really can be some equanimity. You know, that's like it made practice kind of hit home for me. That is, you know, it's not about just like these cosmic things. That is about how you react to life. A danger there for me was I thought, like, if I'm getting upset, then there's something wrong with my practice. You know, I haven't reached this equanimity of Akwin. And what I took me a really long time to realize, you know, with help from my teachers, was practice is not about never being upset. It's how you relate to that upset. Like, because, you know, it's, you know, if something bad happens, you're going to be upset. I mean, that's just, you know, you're a machine, you know, you're a living creature in a world, you know, and you get upset when bad things happen. And I think where practice really hits is not that you don't get upset, is like, do you cling to it? And, you know, do you ruminate about it and like create these narratives and stuff? And so I kind of took the wrong message from that story, but I see it with a little different light now. The next thing I read, and then I went to college. At Humboldt State, and they had like a Buddhist studies there or something. So the library had like stacks of Buddhist books, and I would go in there like 8 a.m. on a Saturday, and I would just be there all day, you know, just reading these Zen books. I was just so fascinated. And the one book they had there was by Bankai, or about Bankai. You guys familiar with Bankai? Unborn Zen. I recommend you guys read about it. Is it really fascinating story? Anyway, again, the most interesting part of the book for me was, you know, his biography, and I'll just kind of paraphrase it a little bit instead of reading it. But so basically, he was this kid, and back then, anyone, you know, I don't know if it was just like middle class or above families, but at least a lot of kids, they got Confucius training in school, and there was a quote about bright virtue, you know, by Confucius, and he asked his teacher, like, what's bright virtue? And they're like, I don't know, sounds like something maybe a Buddhist priest would know, you know, don't ask me. And so he went and asked the Buddhist priest, you know, what is bright virtue? And he's like, well, if you want to know, you have to do some zazen. And, you know, and then he stopped going to school, and his brother, who was at this point, I think his father had died. So his brother, really interestingly, a really large percentage of Zen priests from Japan and stuff that became famous and their stories have been saved, lost parents at a young age. Or, you know, or some other, or their family lost their livelihood. You know, some sort of, you know, Dogen lost his parents, you know, very young age, for example. And so for a lot of these people, it's like an early glimpse at impermanence was like kind of what drove him to practice. And he was no different. You know, he lost his father, bright virtue. And so he started practicing. What intrigued me about this story, two things. Were one, I was really, because like in Three Pillars of Zen, they talk about like this tremendous effort, you know, going to all these sesshins and all this. I think that they obviously take it too far, but I think there's some truth that if you want to wake up, you got to put in some effort. You know, you got to put in a lot of hours on the cushion, you know. This is an aside, like they hooked up all these experienced meditators to fMRI machines because they wanted to see the difference what their brains did between like just chilling and not doing anything and then when they were given a task to do. And by accident, they discovered, because they always run a baseline for these, because they compare it to the baseline. But what they discovered by accident when processing the data was that for these very experienced meditators, like people who had like, you know, between 7,000 and 12,000 lifetime hours of meditation, their default mode network, you know, the self, that midline region, self part of the brain, were just like kind of just inherently quiet compared to like the average people in the population. And interestingly, you know, they ran all these correlation studies or processes, and more than anything, it correlated to sesshin hours, you know, retreat hours. And so I think it's just a reality, you know, if you know, Zen, if you're really going to go for it, I think, you know, you got to sit a lot, you know. And so I was really impressed with his intensity to the point where he actually got sick. And they thought he was going to die. And then he, like, felt this lump and he spit it under the wall. And there's this black phlegm. And boom, you know, and then he was like, oh, all things are resolved in the unborn. And that just was one of those things that just hit me. Like that, it was so evocative to me. And like in like reading him and Hakuin's just this intensity of practice that they did. You know, I was, you know, a young kid, and so I just had all this energy and strength. And so that directly led me to going to live in a monastery for a year. You know, I just, you know, and I went, and I went to a sesshin like really early, you know, really a huge mistake. I didn't, it was a nightmare. But I mean, it was really good in the long term, but at the moment it was not my favorite thing I ever did. But, and then, and another thing about Bankai that was really interesting, and this was actually in his, a record of his talks. And one of his students asked him, you know, teacher, you know, is there any difference between you when you first realized the unborn and now, you know? And he said, well, as to my insight into the unborn, you know, it was as strong then as it is now. You know, that's never left me. But my ability to manifest it, I'm paraphrasing significantly, but my ability to own it and manifest it is completely different now. And like that was pretty important for me also for me to hear that, you know, whether, you know, your intuition into the absolute is like, you know, just a subtle intuition or, you know, you a more direct view, that is not enough. You know, there needs to be integration into your daily life. So that was really important for me in growing up in the Zen world. So then the last kind of major figure, you know, and then of course, two more. So the Hakuin, you know, he was kind of the reviver of Rinzai Zen in Japan. You know, he had one of those little insights, and he thought, you know, it's like, I'm enlightened, I'm so awesome, you know, and he went and saw this teacher, what's his name? I can't remember his name. I'm not going to look for it. But it is, and the teacher said, you know, what about Mu? And Hakuin said, like, no hands and feet can touch it. And the teacher went and grabbed his nose and twisted it and says, like, it seems like I can grab it okay. And like, and Hakuin, and then he kept calling him, like, there's different translations of it. Some is like this hole dwelling scoundrel, or like another one is like this like cave dwelling demon. Like basically, you know, he's caught in this belief that like I'm a thing and absolute reality is a thing, and you know, like, you know, like he like took, and so working with him, he kind of surpassed that. And another thing about Hakuin that really grabbed me, because like, you know, for many years my issue was, you know, like I've seen the truth, you know, I know that there's this realm of non-differentiation where there are no problems, but it's not, you know, I'm having lots of problems, you know, and in Hakuin, in one of his autobiography, says like, you know, basically, you know, he's like, I feel like this like wealthy person who has this gym that I can't own, you know, or something. I forget, like some right now. And he's like, and then I discovered, you know, the solution to this. And I'm like, yes, I want to know the solution. And he says, you know, you have to save all beings. And I'm like, what? That's bullshit. You know, like, but you know, I think there's some truth to that. You know, I think it's like, you know, as long as your practice is self conscious, you know, you're trying to make yourself feel better, I think you're kind of trapped, you know. And you know, I think, you know, when your practice broadens to literally, you know, really saving all beings, you know, just organically, I think that really is a transition point in practice. And then so those are the major there's one more. So has anyone read the book Ambivalent Zen? Yeah, so this is a book I read when I was at the monastery. And God, it really spoke to me. And there's this one little, and so he kind of jumps around in the book, you know, when he's when he first discovered Zen with his current kind of Rinzai teacher, with other teachers, you know, so it's very out of order chronologically, but my favorite were always his teacher, contemporary to the time he wrote the book. I forget his name. So let's call him Roshi. Anyway, and so he was going to the Roshi, and he said, you know, telling him all these problems, and the teacher said, he says, "Larry-san, you rich man's son, live most luxury life. Never have to do anything that you don't want." You know, because like he was not really wanting to like give up comfort, and you know, it was like leaving sessions because they were hard and so forth. And then he says, and then Larry says back to him, "So what? What's that got to do with sashin?" The Roshi says, "Okay, you say no to sashin, but what you say when cancer come? Everyone want bad feeling to go away, good feeling stay, but cannot always choose. You running, Larry-san, wandering, all your decisions emotional. Today much excite, you decide. Tomorrow no excite, decision gone. 49 years old, still wandering, like baby. Listen, session easy, zazen easy. Can up from cushion, but cannot up from cancer." And you know, that was really the first time I realized, like, Zen, how all our problems are, you know, geared towards wanting to feel good at almost any cost and avoid feeling bad at any cost. Like I'd never really realized that until I read this. And then after he says, "A silence ensues between us. After a while, Roshi stands, puts the kettle on for tea. He sets out a plate of cookies, spoons, green tea in a bamboo strainer, and sets the strainer in a ceramic pot. Pours water through it and sets the pot between us. After both of us have stared at it for several minutes, I begin to feel uncomfortable." "So, Roshi, how are you today?" "Fine, fine. I'm not sure why, but his answer annoys me. Come on, Roshi. You always say that. Nobody's fine all the time. Don't you ever have bad days?" And the Roshi says, "Bad days? Sure. On bad days, I fine. On good days, I fine." Like, that was another thing that really hit me. So anyway, so those were some of one other story was from Dogen's biography, I think everyone here probably knows Dogen's story. So he's was raised in Japan, was a Tendai monk, and was one of, you know, and was a student of one of the first Zen teachers in Japan, but, you know, just didn't feel quite resolved. And I think he even got Dharma transmission. Which is interesting, all current Zen Soto Zen priests actually have Rinzai transmission. That's not something often talked about. But he's unresolved. He hadn't resolved the great matter. And, you know, his great dilemma was, if we all are innately enlightened, you know, why practice? You know, and anyway, so that was his great, you know, his great virtue type practice koan. And so he went to Japan, which in those days was like, what's that? I went to China, thanks. And which in those days was like legitimately life challenge. You know, there's a good chance you're going to die on the way from either pirates or storms or something. You know, so he made it to China, but he didn't have the right papers or something, so he had to like shell out on the boat before he could get permission to disembark. And one of the Tenzo from Tiantai Monastery, which is the Soto Monastery where Ruijing, who ended up being his teacher, later went to teach at and Dogen practiced with. But anyway, the Tenzo at the time came to the boat to buy, you know, basically shiitake mushrooms, you know, black mushrooms, dried mushrooms. And Dogen was asking him, you know, like, shouldn't you be cooking? Like, why are you here buying the mushrooms? He's like, if not me, then who? You know, like that was another story that really spoke to me. So there's all these narrative stories, and these were all little excerpts of things that really drove my practice. And these were the type of thing, and because literally 100% the reason I practiced was because of these narrative stories. And so that's kind of the theme of the podcast. And if, you know, if you've listened to any, I largely make it very narrative driven. You know, what's going on? What happened in your life? What's going on now? And so that's how that came about. To kind of close up, I want to talk a little bit about what I've learned from the podcast. First thing, we were talking about this earlier, so I'll talk about this first, is so the part of the podcast I like the least by far, it's the only thing I don't like about it, actually, is I don't like cold calling people asking them to be on it. Like, if I had a booking agent, it would be so wonderful, if anyone's interested. But I don't like reaching out to people and saying, like, hey, sorry to bother you, but you have this podcast, blah, 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 you know. I just really, like, I'm not salesman material. Like, I don't like doing it, you know. And, but I noticed pretty early on, very early in the podcast, I didn't want it to be a bunch of white dudes. I wanted to have, since the whole point of the podcast was to inspire people, I wanted to have a diversity of people come from different backgrounds and status of life and so forth. So, because like when people see someone that's a little bit like them and practice work, so to speak, like that would inspire them. So I made an effort very early on to have a lot of as much diversity as possible in my podcast. But if you actually look at it, like the first 20 ones are like white people, you know, like white guys mostly, you know, and which was kind of an embarrassment to me because I wanted to have the diversity. And but what I found really early on is like if you went to a white guy and said like, hey, do you want to come on this podcast and talk about yourself? And they'd be like, absolutely. That's what I've been trained to do my entire life. You know, I'm a white male. Everyone wants to know about what I have to say, you know. But women and minorities of both genders, they would almost never say yes immediately. You know, it was, and there were definitely some white males that were reluctant, you know. Like, I would be reluctant, I'm sure. I mean, I was reluctant when, what's his name? Guy who wrote Crooked Cucumber. Yeah, like, he had me on his podcast. I was like, I'm like, oh, I don't want to do this, but I guess I have to since I make other people do it. But you know, there were a few times where I would have like multi-hour phone calls with people to get them comfortable with the situation, or multiple times. And in theory, I knew about the idea of white privilege and male white privilege, but I kind of saw it more from the perspective of, if you're a white male, it's easier to make it economically, financially in the country. You know, you're given more opportunities. That's kind of where I saw white privilege. But doing this, it is really the first time, like, really what white privilege or white male privilege is about, which is you just think you're the shit. And, like, you know, people want to hear what you have to say. And, you know, and you just, you know, it seeing that, like, people were socialized into being, like, uncomfortable about talking about themselves just made me realize how oppressive, like, kind of white male dominance is in our society. I mean, because it was across the board, dozens and dozens of people. It was a huge eye-opener to me, just how much, cultural conditioning just completely rules us, and to the point where, you know, you just don't even realize it. You know, it's just because it's just the reality that you live within. I think a lot of practice is gaining objectivity of various forms of conditioning on multiple levels. I think the hardest conditioning to see through mitigate is cultural conditioning. I think you can't see it because that's all there is, you know, cultural conditioning. You know, and if you think about it, like going back to Japan during World War II, almost every Zen teacher, I think with the exception of Suzuki Roshi, were very adamantly militaristic and pro imperialism, you know. And because, like, from their perspective, you know, they're sitting there being a nice little island, and, you know, these white imperialists come and, you know, at gunpoint force them to open up and, you know, humiliate them. And so, like, from their perspective, they were kind of being invaded, you know. It was like kind of existential, like our culture is going to be destroyed if we don't fight back, you know. And so, like, a lot of people that I think are legitimately awakened were very much sucked up into the imperialism of their time. And, you know, justifications of emptiness, justifying, fighting and so forth. And because you know, because you and the person you're fighting are one and all that kind of stuff. And so I mean, it just goes to show just how much you know, cultural conditioning is almost impossible to escape. Jody, you want to grab that?
I think you're correct about that, but I think there's another element to it that also is that if people spoke out against the war, off with their heads.
Right.
So, you know, there was, so people were often quiet and didn't say anything in protest because the alternative was not very good.
Right, which is the situation Suzuki was in, but I agree with you. And I think the problem is where people weren't just quiet, but they were actively pro it, you know what I mean? Yeah. And, you know, I mean, Suzuki, if you read Crooked Cucumber, you know, he very deftly did his best to, like, I'm just asking questions kind of approach, you know, like, I'm not saying the war is bad, but, you know, he actually was investigated over it. Even his, like, very mild non-excitement about the war was enough to be investigated by essentially the secret police, you know. So that's one thing to learn is just doing this podcast is really kind of gave me insight into male white privilege in this country. I was I'm you know, what you know, a liberal who's you know very predisposed to wanting to see this kind of stuff, and it was just invisible to me. You know, another thing was how many people it really surprised me. How many people afterwards was like, was that okay? You know. Can we use that? You know, just like, you know, very prominent Zen teachers, like, were worried how good of a job they did, which really surprised me. Another thing that I've kind of learned from this, I don't know if it's more perspective than learning, is people always ask me, like, what are the good podcasts? Which one should I listen to first? And I really don't have any favorites. Like, I just think all the stories are interesting. You know, like, there's a few people that came on just kind of promote a book that maybe I was a little less intrigued by, but even then, like I just find everyone's story fascinating. Like I don't have any favorites or anything. Another thing I've learned is this is an oversimplification because there's many exceptions in both directions. But one thing I noticed is Soto people would often characterize their POWs as healing, whereas people that were more from kind of the Rinzai or Harada Roshi lineages, Harada Yasuhani lineages, it was more like discovery, you know. So like that was really interesting. Like it's kind of like two different, and again, there's major exceptions on both sides, but that seemed to be a theme that I found really interesting. Another thing is if you look at the raw viewership numbers, like I've had some podcasts that have hit like between Yahoo and the actual podcast networks, they've hit like 3,000 views. And the higher views by far, and like by contrast, some only have like 300 you know, combined views. And generally, the more kind of suburban lay your practice has been, the lower your views are. The views that really people are really interested in hearing about are people that who have done like monastic time and practice a very traditional Zen. Like those are the ones that really get the viewership, which is interesting because I always felt like for Zen to really spread in America, it needs to become more lay focused. Because I, you know, even though I'm ordained and stuff, I mean, I'm a householder, you know, I have a family, I have a job, you know, I'm not a renunciate on any level except other than I attempt to renunciate my my you know lust for feeling good and avoid feeling bad. You know, that's where renunciation kind of speaks to me. But whereas like these other people, like, you know, like Kokyo's a monk, right? You know, he literally has given up, he's no career, he's literally no home unless somebody invites him to live at their temple or whatever. Like these type of people are these are the stories that most seem to intrigue people, which really surprised me, which would have been, if you'd asked me before the podcast, I would have guessed like the people that people like, you know, more just like lay people who are making it work, you know, having a kid and jobs, like I thought those would be more intriguing, but people really have a thirst for like authenticity and people who have really gone all in on the practice, which I felt interesting. So yeah, that's kind of what I wanted to talk about. anyone have any questions or maybe how narratives have influenced your own path, or maybe if any of you have listened to the podcast, any stories that kind of spoke to you, or we can send it here if not, and online too.
Well, one of the things that often comes up about the stories that are told is in Zen is that they couldn't really be true, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, because of this and such a date, he wasn't there, and so on and so forth. But following what Oscar said, you know, what we care about, you know, this is from my teacher too, Reb Anderson. What we just care about is the story, yeah. You know, and all that stuff about, well, you know, it couldn't really have happened that way, or he wasn't there, you know, is not the point. You know, it's really not the point. Mm-hmm. And it's just, and then the other thing I was thinking about when you said, you said several times in your talk, you said, it really hit me. Mm-hmm. And I thought that the really hit me is also important, because when it really hits you, it's what you know is already true. You already know it's true. And it just like, oh yeah, that's exactly how it is. It's just a recognition, you know.
Right on.
Yeah.
That's great.
You know, thank you for your talk. When you were talking about the experiments and the brain, you know, with the random sounds and then the stories told out of, or words out of order and stuff, it brought to mind a novel I read some years ago that's actually constructed in that way, where five different stories were recorded and then played back in random order in 3 to 5 second intervals, and then this became the novel. And I can't say much for the subject matter of the book, but the effect it has on your mind trying to absorb all these disparate things is quite interesting.
Mm-hmm. Was it like disconcerting or?
In a way. And you really wonder what, just, you know, you start, after a while, you kind of pick up on it and you start trying to pick the stories apart. But, yeah, it had a very interesting effect on, you know, just how you think about stuff. The book is called The Ticket That Exploded by William S. Burroughs, and it was kind of an experimental novel, and it's still one of my favorite books.
What's that movie where they tell it backwards with the guy with the tattoos? Memento, right. That's the, maybe when you're saying that, maybe think of that.
Thank you for your talk, Barry-san. What I'm going to say, I'm not saying that this is how you think by being interested in narratives. I love narratives myself. But I think, you know, and to me, it's one thing to listen to a, you know, somebody with so much experience talk and talk about their lives. I think it's always good to say, well, that's their life. Mm-hmm. And not say, you know, I wish I could be. I wish, I, you know, then there's your life. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's where I think it's really at. So, you know, I hope that people don't get so enamored with somebody else's life that they forget about their, you know, and try and, you know, instead of emulating, all of that is right there in your own life. So,
yeah. I mean, even like, you know, I mentioned Kokyo. I mean, there's times where, I mean, Kokyo is just one of my favorite Dharma teachers in the world. I have a huge Dharma crush on him, and like, but like, there's, you know, because there was an inflection point where, like, you know, I was living at a monastery, you know, I assumed that, you know, this is it, you know, this is my, you know, I'm going to be a rafting guide in the summer, make money to pay for practice periods, and, you know, this is going to be my life, you know. And but, you know, just life went another way, and I had a career, and I even had a .com startup, and, you know, wife and kids. I mean, like, a very, you know, very different path than, you know, just being a all-in practitioner at a monastery. And, you know, and then and Kokyo and I were kind of similar ages, and, you know, we kind of, I think he went in a couple years before I did, and he just stayed in where I didn't. And I thought, you know, and as I got into Kokyo, I thought, like, oh, you know, that could have been me, like, you know, and with a little bit of a wistfulness to it, you know. But then I, like you said, I realized, like, no, this was my path, and this is how I, and this is how it unfolded for me. And, you know, so yeah, I agree.
Chadwick was a good one, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. We have a question on Zoom.
Yeah. Hi, Alicia.
Hi, Barry. Thanks for your talk. Really interesting stuff. I'm a frustrated journalist myself, so I can really relate to the excitement around interviewing folks. I also really appreciate, from the bottom of my heart, addressing white male privilege. I don't want to, you know, be too on the nose about it, but if you look at the room right now, you can see that, you know, is still a reality. I wonder if that topic came up with you and people of color or women that you spoke with, and if in those conversations or on your own, you had any, I don't know, ideas about how that could be, or if it should be addressed in the Zen or the Buddhist community at large.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I have had those conversations. You know, and I've asked, you know, I don't think I've asked it during the interviews, but I think in like pre or post discussion, I'm like, you know, what can we do to make sanghas more inclusive? And one answer I got a couple times was a little surprising to me. Like, it's not our job to make your sangha more inclusive. You know, like that's kind of something you need to figure out, you know. So I don't know the answer really. And I mean, you know, Dora Lee, oh, she took office, right? But, you know, she's done a lot of work in this area. She could probably answer this a lot better than I could. But one thing I did hear was the reason a lot of people of color and diversity of sexualities don't always feel comfortable in sanghas is because people are kind of like inadvertently racist towards them. Like, you know, I'm not going to give any examples because like nothing was ever stuff they could share, but like something along that way would be like, where are you from? Like Oakland? No, where are you from? You know, like that type of thing. You know, like, you know, I'm from Oakland. I'm an American. Like, what are you actually implying here? You know, like that type of thing. Or people just say insensitive things. Or in a lot of it, I think just people, you know, they walk into a room and like no one. You know, no one looks like me. No one's had my background. You know, they can't relate to me, you know, a lot of that. So, you know, I think affinity groups are big. You know, I know like Brooklyn Zen Center is, you know, they're one of the sanghas that really made an effort to be diverse and, you know, make the Dharma acceptable. And a lot of the way they did it is they've just let people own it, you know, like people create their own affinity groups and run it themselves. So it's not like, because like even like the idea of like, you know, I'm this wise white guy and I'm going to fix the situation. Like that is kind of in a way almost like perpetuating the problem. You know what I mean? Like, you know, it's like there's a degree of like paternalism there, you know? So that's kind of the messages I've got, you know? And so there's no quick answers. You know, I think a lot of it is just, you know, San Francisco's Zen Center has been really good at having a diversity of different teachers. And affinity groups as well. And I think a lot of it is just like that, you know. Does that answer your question at all, Alicia?
Yep, totally. And I
okay.
Hope I didn't offend anybody. I just I think it's a really interesting topic and a great source of growth.
Mm-hmm. All right, we good? Anyone else?
I just had this feeling when you were talking about Hakuin and when Jim was talking about stories. One of the first books, the first Zen book I ever read was Paul Repp's Zen Flesh, Zen Bones. And I remember reading that story for the first time, and I've read it many times in that book and in other books. And Reb was very impressed by that story too, and I've heard him tell that story many times and reference it many, many times. And
is that so?
Is that so? Uh-huh. So Adeska. and I've heard him often say, telling his story, narrating his path. That's what led me to Zen. That narrative. I want to be like that. I've heard him say that so many times. That's why I came to Zen. I want to be like that.
That story.
Like that story. Yeah. And then hearing you tell about that story, and it's like layers, you know, of this narrative is echoing through the universe, the cultural universe. Through the centuries, and it gives me a feeling of a sort of I don't know, a unity, like connection between, you know,
like a family.
It's like, yeah, it's like, oh, so what is time, you know? Different people at different times have related to this story. And I was also impressed, or what resonates is your story about Bankai,
the unborn.
The unborn, yes. Zen, the unborn Zen.
It's just the unborn.
The unborn.
Yeah, it's like, you know, it's like Nirvana's uncreated. You know,
yeah. And his story and several things you said about, well, it's not necessarily about Kensho. It's about expressing that and a feeling I had the other day of oh, this is it. This being with myself right now, there's no other time, just kind of having it together right now. This is it, there's nothing else. It's just right now, this. So thank you so much for the talk. It's really, you wove so many themes together, brain science and a lot of other stuff.
I messed up the narrative.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This will be the last question, right? It's almost nine. I echo my thanks, especially your observation about how difficult it is to get you as a white male asking a person of color or a woman to come on and the different response. And it just occurred to me, since I'm a woman, that when I look at stories and stories that people tell in the Zen communities that I'm in, it's always the men who talk up first. And if you take about how many times the women in this meeting ask a question, it's pretty rare. We don't ask questions. And one thing that just occurred to me is that when you said, how you had to keep, you know, calling back and asking them. It's maybe that, and I'm speaking now to the men, maybe that's reaching out to some of the women who are sitting in this heavily dominated white male group, reaching out to some of us to elicit a response, because we're overwhelmed by the male voices, and because the male voices don't have any reservations about speaking out because they have something to say, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That's not the way the women, I'm speaking maybe just for myself, but I'm looking at the other two women in the room, we listen. And we might be thinking something, but usually we're thinking, well, you know, no one's really going to be interested in that comment.
Or I'm going to be mansplained.
Yeah, I'm going to be squished. Someone's going to tell me, well, but I read a bigger book than you, so I know that better than you do, which happens to us. So just a suggestion for maybe in our own Sangha, how to, you know, work with that process, because I think it's a big issue in Zen. I can't tell you how many times I'm the only woman sometimes in that room. So, but it just your experience of having to elicit and take more time with women, I think just made me think, oh, maybe that would be a way for us to become more inclusive.
Thank you. I totally agree. It makes me think of, my wife's told me a lot of stories. She's a white collar employee at SMUD, and she a lot of times she'll be in a you know, like a boardroom talk, you know, meeting room, and she'll say something, and the male colleagues will just, you know, shout her down, basically, you know, or she'll say something and no one will care, but then a man will make the same suggestion. Everyone's like, oh, that's a wonderful idea, you know.
I can't tell you how many times that's happened to me.
Yeah.
Or you make a suggestion and there's total silence, uh-huh. And then 15 minutes later, a man makes the same suggestion. Oh, that's a great idea.
Yeah.
That's happened to me more than once.
Yeah, so, but, I mean, I think the first step is just being aware of it. You know, like, you know, I'm somebody who's predisposed to wanting to know this stuff about myself, and I was completely blind to it prior to this. Not completely blind, but significantly blind to it prior to this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just think being open to it and just being aware of it's the kind of the first step. Thank you for saying that. Appreciate it.